This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Guys, if you've been wearing the same underwear since you were a teenager, it's time to upgrade. And Mack Weldon has upgraded underwear. They use smart design, premium fabrics that are naturally antimicrobial, so it reduces that crotch smell you sometimes get with your underwear. And the shopping experience is super simple. So if you want to check out Mack Weldon for your socks, underwear, and undershirts, go to mackweldon.com and use promo code AOM at checkout to get 20% off your purchase. Again, mackweldon.com, promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Also by Thrive Market. So we all know that eating healthy is part of becoming a better man. If you found that shopping organic or using, you know, the natural food products is expensive or it's just hard to find, well, here's a solution for you. It's called thrivemarket.com. Thrivemarket.com, the best way to describe it is like Amazon or Costco meets Whole Foods. Everything's online. A lot of the products you'll find in natural food stores, you'll find on thrivemarket.com. But here's the catch. You can get some of these brands up to 50% off retail prices, and they're shipped nationally to your door free within 2 to 3 days. That's right, 50% off, and you get free shipping. I've actually started to use Thrive Market more and more for some of the stuff that I buy at Whole Foods, the non-perishable stuff, saving me a lot of money and a lot of hassle. I don't have to go to the grocery store all the time. So if you want to try this out, go to thrivemarket.com/artofmanliness and sign up. You'll get an additional 20% off your first purchase. Again, thrivemarket.com/artofmanliness. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, today, sports is a multi-billion dollar industry. Football, basketball, soccer, baseball. I mean, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people come to watch these sports. They watch them on television. The athletes are making millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, their salary, plus there's the endorsement deals that go along with it. But here's the thing, that this all started, this whole mega sports industry that we have today, started with the super exciting sport that happened in the 19th century of competitive walking. Yes, I'm being serious. My guest today dug up this long forgotten sport that really kicked off the modern sport era. His name is Matthew Algio. He wrote a book called Pedestrianism: When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. And it's just a fascinating look at a lost bit of American history that has a wider influence on sport today. Everything that we know about sport today, with the endorsement deals, super high salaries, super high payouts, thousands of people watching a sport, this all started with competitive walking, which is really bizarre. I mean, it happened during the late 19th century, during a time that I like. It's when, you know, boxing was coming to rise, John L. Sullivan, Teddy Roosevelt was coming to power. You had the rise of mass media, the rise of consumer culture, and all these things came together around competitive walking. Well, today on the podcast, Matthew Algio and I discuss this long forgotten sport and how it influences sport today. So really fun, interesting look into a forgotten bit of history. So without further ado, Pedestrianism with Matthew Algio. Matthew Algio, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're welcome. So the reason I invited you, because I forgot where I heard about your book, but it's talking about this obscure sport that I knew nothing about, even though like Gilded Age America is one of my favorite parts of American history, right? You have the rise of prize fighting. You know, we got John L. Sullivan on the masthead of our website, Teddy Roosevelt, all this stuff. But I had no idea that there's a sport called pedestrianism, which is just basically walking. Was the most popular sport in America for about 40 years. I'm curious, how did you come across this bit of forgotten American history?
Well, it's definitely been forgotten. I was actually researching a book about 8 or 9 years ago about the 1943 merger of the Steelers and the Eagles. You might be aware of this. They were the Steagles for a season.
Yeah.
Because in 1943, during World War II, the teams were so short of players, they had to merge two teams. So they merged the Steelers and the Eagles. So I was writing a book about the Steagles. And while I was researching that book, I, you know, did some research on the history of spectator sports in the United States. And I'm like you, I'm a big fan of the Gilded Age. I love the 1890s, the 1880s. And I was blown away to realize that when I was researching the history of spectator sports, that in the 1880s and 1890s, this sport of pedestrianism was the most popular spectator sport in the United States. People, thousands, tens of thousands of people would fill arenas to watch guys walk around a dirt track for days at a time. And this was just the most entrancing, fascinating thing that was going on in the Gilded Age. And people bet on this. I mean, it's funny, right now we have all this controversy about, fantasy sports and online betting with fantasy sports. I mean, this was the original fantasy sport. People would bet on anything about these guys. Who would be the first to walk 100 miles? Who would be the first to drop out of the race? It was just like the most amazing spectator sport in the United States for, like you said, a real short period of time. But for that period of time in the 1880s and 1890s, it ruled.
Yeah, and like newspapers, were, like the New York Times would write about it. The National Police Gazette, we've talked about a bit about that on the show and the website before. They
loved it.
They loved the pedestrianism. Because it was like a freak of nature. I mean, it was what it came down to.
One of the most popular form of pedestrianism was the 6-day race, okay? So guys would walk for 6 days beginning. You couldn't, because back then, of course, on Sundays, you couldn't have any entertainment.
Yeah, blue laws.
Blue laws, exactly. And so the races would begin right after midnight Monday morning and then continue right up until midnight Saturday night. So it was 6 days long. And during this time, you would have the newspapers covering the event. They would be posting updates all over the city on billboards, and people would just be following it. They would have extra editions of the newspapers published to show who was in front, you know, who was leading at that time of the day, on Monday morning, on Tuesday afternoon, on Wednesday afternoon. And so it really was just an amazing cultural phenomenon at the time.
Yeah. So you said it was a high stakes game, like lots of money was, we'll talk about how much the purses were for these competitions. It was insane. But the gambling that was involved, but like what's funny about pedestrianism is that it got started on a bet. Tell us a little bit about the story of how pedestrianism got its start.
Sure. It was the 1860 presidential election. And of course, Abraham Lincoln was the Republican candidate in 1860. And there were about three other candidates. The Democratic Party was split. But there was a guy in Boston, a guy named Edward Payson Weston, and he bet a friend that Lincoln would lose the election in 1860. And of course, Lincoln wins the election in 1860. The terms of the bet, though, were unusual. Weston had to walk from Boston to Washington in time to see the election, or in time to see the inauguration of Lincoln in March of 1861. And so Weston did this walk. It's the middle of winter. He's walking from Boston to Washington, and it really caught the nation's attention. He became a very popular figure in the media. The newspapers covered this walk. Would Weston make it to Washington in time to see Lincoln's inauguration? Weston actually was about 4 hours late to the inauguration. He didn't win the bet. He lost the bet. He didn't fulfill the wager. But he became such a sensation that people all over the country wanted to see Weston walk. I mean, it blows your mind, but people came out, you know, just to see him walk through their town when he was doing this walk from Boston to Washington. And he figured, well, there's got to be a way I can monetize this. And so he started taking his act on the road, and he walked indoors in roller skating rinks. He tried to walk 100 miles in 24 hours, that sort of thing. And that's how he became a very famous pedestrian. He started the whole idea of competitive walking in the United States.
And he was actually a showman, which I thought was really interesting. He wasn't really much of he was an athlete, he was able to do these things, but he brought a bit of showmanship into the sport.
I like to say he was the Abraham Lincoln. He was the Muhammad Ali of the 1870s. He understood just instinctively the connection between entertainment and sports. So he would say, for instance, he would walk 100 miles in 24 hours, which is really an incredible feat. It's hard to do even today. But when he did it, he wore long velvet coats, and he always carried a cane, and he wore a top hat, and he always had a, you know, he wore a necktie or a cravat. He understood that you had to play to the crowd. He really had, I mean, it was almost ahead of its time in the way he understood that you really had to entertain at the same time that you were performing an athletic feat. Like I say, it's a lot like Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, and this was the during the Gilded Age. This is really when mass media was starting, and I guess he was one of those first people who intuitively understood the power of mass media. I think Teddy Roosevelt was like the first president that really understood the power of mass media. And I guess Weston was the first athlete who understood the power of mass media to catapult him to fame and riches.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm working on a book about Roosevelt right now and how he played the media. Weston really, he played the media so well. And I don't mean that in a negative way. He knew that the picture on the front page of the paper was more dramatic if he was wearing a long flowing coat and carrying his, you know, gold-topped cane. I mean, he really understood how entertainment worked, how sports worked, how business worked. I mean, he was one of the first athletes to really become interested, invested in his own business. He you know, negotiated his own contracts. I mean, this was unheard of at the time. Most athletes were sort of led along by guys who took advantage of them. But Weston wasn't like that. He was kind of the first generation of athletes who really knew how to capitalize on their fame.
So how did it transition? How did it start from Weston doing this bet, basically, to right. walk to all the way to Washington, D.C., right. and transform into this thing where there was competitive leagues, like there were matches and money was at stake? How did that transition happen? And here's the other question, like, why did that happen? What sort of cultural forces were going on at the time that allowed pedestrianism to be the most popular spectator sport in America?
Well, really, one of the things was that roller skating became very popular. And the roller skate was invented, the kind we know today with the four wheels on the bottom that you can lean and turn. And roller skating rinks popped up all over the country. And these were really kind of the first enclosed public spaces. And so there were these venues that were sitting there with nothing to do except roller skating. And Weston, who had just walked from Boston to Washington, realized that all these people wanted to watch him walk, and all these roller skating rinks were out there. And so he would go to a roller skating rink, and he'd set up a track, and it might be 50 laps to a mile. I mean, these were tiny little roller skating rinks. But he would go in there, and he would charge people 10 cents to go watch him walk 100 miles in 24 hours, that sort of thing. So it was this weird convergence of indoor spaces and the Weston, people like him, seeing how they could capitalize on these indoor public spaces for the first time. And you also have to remember, at the time, we're talking about after the Civil War, for the first time, people have a little extra money in their pockets. You see industrialization coming in. People have a little extra time on their hands, extra time, extra money. These indoor roller skating rinks, Edward Pace and Weston traveling around the country, walking 100 miles in 24 hours all over the country. And so all these things came together and sort of turned what was this weird bet that he could walk from Boston to Washington into a professional sport.
Yeah, and I guess at the time, baseball was just getting started, so that wasn't a factor. They weren't competing with baseball. Prize fighting was around, but that was an underground sport and looked down upon. So
right.
walking—
And you also have to remember, like, baseball sort of had a bad reputation. Boxing, of course, had a bad reputation. Pedestrianism was a wholesome sport. It was walking. What could be more wholesome? And walking. And so really, it was this void that Weston filled when he started going around the country staging these walking exhibitions that said, you could bring the family. It was family entertainment 5 or 10 cents a person. And you could take the family to go see it. You would never take the family to go see John L. Sullivan. And even baseball at the time had a bad reputation. And so it really was the first family entertainment, mass entertainment in the United States in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s.
We're going to take a quick break for your word from our sponsors. All right, guys, it's a new year, and if you're looking to jumpstart your business or create a personal resume for yourself out there online to take control of your reputation that's out there on online, check out Squarespace. Squarespace makes creating a website super simple. It really is literally point and click, and you can have a beautiful looking website that looks great on desktop, mobile, and tablet. Along with that, they have state-of-the-art technology that really up the performance of your site. They also have 24/7 online support. I wish I had this, something like this when I first started creating websites online. Really takes a lot of the pain and headache out of it. So if you're looking for a discount on this, I got one for you. If you go to squarespace.com and use the offer code ARTOFMAN, all one word, you'll get 10% off your first purchase. So again, squarespace.com, offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout for 10% off your first purchase. And as well, that will help support the Art of Manliness podcast. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Also by Creative Live. And if one of your other resolutions this year is to learn a new skill to improve your business, your something, a hobby you want to do, check out Creative Live. Creative Live offers great online classes to help people enhance or dig into new skills like photography, design, music, production, and even business savvy. I've done a few of the courses. I've done the ones with Ryan Holiday on marketing, as well as Ramit Sethi on personal finance. Top notch, really a lot of great information where they go into detail, and the quality of the production is fantastic on the Creative Live classes. So if you want to try out a Creative Live class with a discount, go to creativelive.com/artofman for 20% off any of Creative Live's classes. Again, creativelive.com/artofman for 20% off any of their classes. So besides having these expeditions where people would pay to watch, it evolved to becoming a sport where there were like belts, like they created a belt system, right? Like prize fighting.
Right.
Can you talk a little about what I thought was just mind boggling was the amount of money, the purses that these walkers, these pedestrians could win. Can you talk a little about some of the prizes that were won by some of these athletes?
Right. So you got Weston, and he's going out, he's walking these exhibitions. And of course, people see how much money he's making, and competitors arise naturally. And the biggest competitor was a guy named Daniel O'Leary. He was an Irish immigrant, and he figured, well, if Weston can walk 100 miles in 24 hours, I can walk 105 miles in 24 hours. And eventually they met in a race. And it was a 6-day race, as we mentioned earlier. That was as long as you could race. The first big race was in Chicago. But this sort of morphed into these 6-day races involving all sorts of competitors from the United States and from Great Britain. And as you mentioned, the payouts on these races were tremendous, because think about it. It's a 6-day race. You're at the first Madison Square Garden. They might have 10,000 seats, but it's continuous. It's for 6 days. And so people are coming and going constantly. So you could have 500,000 people maybe come and see this race over the course of a week, because you might come in and see it for 5 minutes and leave. And so everybody was paying 50 cents or a dollar a ticket. The winner of the race might receive $25,000, $40,000, which today is $1 million. I mean, this is for 6 days' work. Whoever won would get $1 million for 6 days' work. This actually stands up to what you see for professional athletes today.
Yeah.
You know, because $1 million for a week is $50 million for a year. That's a pretty good baseball player right there, even today.
And besides the payouts, did some of these athletes get sponsorship deals like modern athletes do?
Yeah. What was interesting, you mentioned the Police Gazette before. You guys know all about the Police Gazette.
Yeah.
But they were one of the big sponsors, because they covered the races. People who subscribed to the Police Gazette loved pedestrianism. And so they had a guy that they paid, I think, $2,000 to wear a shirt that just had the Police Gazette logo on it during a race.
Oh, wow.
And so you had I mentioned Dan O'Leary earlier. He was the spokesperson for a brand of salt. when I need to resalt, I use Tiger salt.
Yeah.
So these guys, they were some of the first athlete spokesmen in the United States. It was really is the beginning of this whole sports industrial complex.
Yeah. And they were also the first on sports cards, right? Like the cigarette cards.
Yeah. Cigarette cards really came out, started beginning in the 1870s and 1880s. And I've got a couple of them. Some of the first athletes featured on these sporting cards were pedestrians. Frank Hart, who was actually one of the first famous black athletes in the United States. He was an African-American who won a couple of major pedestrian events. He's probably the first African-American ever featured on a trading card in the United States. All these guys are forgotten now. Nobody remembers them. That's probably not why nobody's buying my book. But I really think that they were a huge part of American sports history, and I really think they need to be remembered.
Yeah, tell us a little more about Frank Hart, because I thought this was really interesting. I mean, this was before Plessy v. Ferguson.
Yes.
And people always had this idea that sports and has always been segregated, but there was a time right before Plessy v. Ferguson, when separate but equal was the law of the land, where you had black athletes who were competing and doing really well in competitive sports in America. Can you tell us a little bit more about Frank Hart?
Yeah, and there were even black athletes. There were black baseball players in the 1880s and 1890s. You're right. Plessy v. Ferguson ended everything. It ended any kind of integration that was going on. The beauty of pedestrianism was that anybody who could walk could do it. And almost everybody can walk. Black people can walk. Chinese people can walk. White people can walk. It was amazing the variety of people you had in pedestrian events, because anybody who could walk could take part. And it didn't matter what your race was, what your color was. And this was people tend to forget this, that in the Gilded Age, you had this weird period between Reconstruction and Plessy v. Ferguson, as you mentioned, where there was a wide open field, really. I mean, I make the argument in the book that things were a lot better for African-American athletes between Reconstruction and Plessy versus Ferguson than they were between Plessy and, Jackie Robinson. I mean, black people could take part in sporting events with white people. And Frank Hart was one of those people, an African-American, who took part in these events, and he won several six-day races. His picture was on the front page of the New York newspapers. I mean, it was amazing for an African-American at that time to do what he did. And it's a shame that he couldn't, that it really ended with Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yeah, and he won a lot of money too.
And these guys won so much money. You really don't appreciate, but winning $12,000-$15,000 in 1889 was like winning $500,000 today.
Yeah.
And really, for 6 days' work, you could take $500,000 home. If these guys won two races a year, they won $1 million a year. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, I guess something we haven't really talked about is how these races actually went down. So a lot of them were 6 day races, but they weren't walking continuously for 6 days. How did the whole walking match occur, and what were some of the rules that governed these events?
Okay, for a walking match, strictly, 1 foot had to be on the ground at all times, heel toe, just like today. For you have these walking in the Olympics, you have 10, 50-kilometer walking matches. So you see the way people walk, that sort of funny swiveling their hips kind of walk. That's how people walked. But the match will begin, as I mentioned earlier, right after midnight on Monday morning. Typically, it would continue right up until midnight on Saturday night. There would be tents erected in the middle of the middle of the track. There'd be a dirt track on the floor. It'd be maybe an eighth or a seventh of a mile around. It'd be inside an arena. Almost always, these were indoor events. And whoever walked the most miles over those 6 days would be the winner. You could stop whenever you wanted. You could go rest in your tent. Most people ate while they walked. They might eat some greasy eel broth or something like that. It wasn't really the kind of, you know, nutrition that people take today. But whoever walked the most miles in 6 days was the winner. That was the most common race, the 6 day race.
Gotcha. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how they kept themselves, you know, some of the things they did. You know, you mentioned the greasy eel broth, but like, I guess champagne was like a really popular drink to keep you going.
They thought alcohol was a stimulant. And so a lot of guys would drink a lot of alcohol and then sometimes literally fall off the track. It was just amazing that it took them a while to figure out that you probably shouldn't be drinking during the race. But the guys who took it most seriously, really, they did training. I mean, I tend to, you know, make fun of them or whatever, but the guys who were very serious about it, they did a lot of training. They did a lot of running, a lot of jogging, that sort of thing. I mean, they were athletes on a par with the athletes of today.
Well, speaking of how pedestrianism really laid the foundation of modern sport in America, you talk about how pedestrianism had America's first doping scandal. Not that this was really funny too. So,
yeah. Edward Payson Weston, who we had mentioned earlier, he took part in a race in the UK, it was discovered that he was chewing coca leaves, and this was, of course, a stimulant. But at the time, there were no rules. I mean, this was one of the problems with pedestrianism, and one of the reasons it died is that there was no governing body of pedestrianism. Mm. There was no commissioner of pedestrianism. There was, you know, nobody to really take control of the sport. And so when Weston was found to be chewing these coca leaves, there was nobody to enforce any rule to say it was wrong. There's nobody to tell him that he should be expelled from the sport, that sort of thing. And so it really sort of just went, by that Weston got away with this. He later insisted that it gave him no competitive advantage. But of course, that's what everybody says when they chew coca leaves, I guess.
When they get caught, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned, okay, there was a lack of an organizing body that led to the decline, but what other factors led to the decline of pedestrianism, and why was it forgotten from American history?
Wow. Well, you know, baseball really, I mentioned that pedestrianism had no commissioner. Well, baseball in 1876, the owners of baseball teams organized the National League, and baseball really became the American pastime within 10, 20 years of that. They had a commissioner. They could oversee the sport. They could wipe out gambling. They could maintain the integrity of the sport. Pedestrianism had nothing like that. Also, the invention of the bicycle. Remember, the old-time 19th century bicycle is that kind with the big, huge front wheel.
Yeah, and that hipsters and that drive around today. Bag. Yeah.
Exactly. I saw that on Gawker recently. But anyway, yes, so the hipsters who drive these big bicycles around. But those were very hard to race. They weren't very nimble. The invention of the safety bicycle in the 1880s, that's the bicycle we drive today, with the two same size wheels and the drive chain. Well, that was much more interesting to watch race for 6 days than people walking around a track. And so the combination of baseball and the bicycle really eliminated pedestrianism from the, you know, sporting scene in the United States. People just stopped watching it, moved on to other sports, moved on to more interesting things. As for why they're forgotten, I don't know. I mean, why would you remember who people, you know, why would you remember people who walked? I don't know.
But I thought it was, excuse me. I thought it was interesting too, towards the end of its heyday, like moral crusaders started going after pedestrianism, much in the same way they went after prize fighting or bullfighting or cockfighting.
Well, one of the most entertaining things about watching a 6-day race was going in to watch day number 5 or 6, because people, the competitors would be so bedraggled. They would be so worn out. They'd almost be dead on their feet. I mean, that was the exciting thing, was to go watch these people after 5 or 6 days of continuously walking, what they would look like, how they would behave. And so there were crusaders, morality crusaders, and they were aligned with the temperance movement, who came in and said, this is, you know, making fun of these people. This is... It's like exhibitionism. It's immoral to watch these people after 5 or 6 days. And so there was the weight of this crusade came down on pedestrianism, and it really had a hard time recovering from that.
Yeah. So we forgot about pedestrianism, but it did lay the groundwork for modern sports as far as its connection to mass media, its connection to gambling, the connection to, you know, athletic sponsorships. But I'm curious, I mean, I think you mentioned Olympic walking. Is that a remnant of pedestrianism?
It is. Walking is one of the very few sports that has been in the Olympics continuously since the very first Olympics in, what was it, 1896? I forget. But I think really you see, and I don't think it's a stretch to say, pedestrianism, really you see it more in even Major League Baseball or the NFL, where the idea of capitalizing on an athletic event, pedestrianism was one of the first sports to figure out a way to monetize itself. There were sponsorships. There were championships. There were all sorts of different ways to make money. And that's all what sports is about today.
Yeah.
Making money. And pedestrianism was the first sport, I really think, you know, because the other sports were sort of under the radar, boxing and baseball. I mean, they were kind of either for gentlemen or for ruffians. But pedestrianism was the first sport that was for the general populace, and they figured out a way to make money.
I'm curious, did writing this book, like, did you start walking more? Because they're like, I'm gonna try doing one of those feats, or did you start walking more because it was like, after reading, I was like, I'm going to start walking more.
I encourage you to attempt a 24-hour race. I actually did a 24-hour race. People came up to me and said, have you ever done this? No. So actually last year in October, I did a 24-hour race in New Jersey, and I walked it. Just walk for 24 hours, see how far you go. And I did 51 miles. So I am proud to say that, yes, after all that, I was inspired to attempt a 24-hour race.
Very good. I'm going to give that a try. I'm going to do it.
You know, but that's half. That's half of what Weston did, or O'Leary did, or Frank Hart did. They would walk 100 miles in a day.
That's crazy.
And so, you know, I mean, your basic walking speed is about 4 miles an hour. So just go walk, but not stop for 24 hours, and you're not at 100 miles. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to give it a try, and I'm going to challenge everyone out there who's listening to go try this too. We're going to get some records on here so we can beat
it's
Weston.
Really cool. The races are a lot of fun. It's really cool that, you know, ultra marathons are not for regular people, but 24-hour races, those kinds of races, a regular person can do it because there's no did not finish.
Yeah.
Everybody finishes.
Yeah.
So it's really a lot of fun.
Very good. Well, Matthew Algio, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, Brett, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. My guest today was Matthew Algio. He's the author of the book Pedestrianism, and you can find that on Amazon.com. Go get it. It's a fun, quick little read, and you're going to find out a bit about American history that a lot of people don't know about. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast, or tell a friend about the show. I'd really appreciate that. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.